the teaching in the Talmud that each of us has heard countless times that frames our understanding of Tisha B'Av, the Gemara from Tractate Yuma, Daf Tes Amud Beis, tells us that our holy Beis HaMikdash, our holy temple in Jerusalem and our holy city was destroyed almost 2,000 years ago because of the Sinat Chinam, the baseless hatred that characterized the relationship between Jewish people. I have to confess to a bad personal habit that I have. I suspect that many of us share this, that if I have a large pile of work to do in the morning, I tend to procrastinate the difficult tasks and I start immediately with the easier ones, doing my emails and my Facebook postings. And it's very easy to get very distracted with all the simpler things to do in life and to put off those things that are more weighty and more difficult. And I think that as a community, we've been masters at doing some important things, but ignoring this probably most crucial task, which is to somehow address this baseless hatred that has been consuming our world for almost the past 2,000 years. The Netziv, in his introduction to Sefer Bereishis, wrote that the problem 2,000 years ago was that our people didn't tolerate others with different views. They automatically labeled them as heretics. And this kind of poisonous climate led to the destruction of Jerusalem. I'm sure many of you know that just within the past week, one of the senior Shas rabbis in Israel attacked the religious Zionists as being Amalek. And the Netziv wrote as follows. Our ancestors 2,000 years ago were righteous, pious men and women who toiled in Torah. But they were not diplomatic. Because of the hatred in their hearts for one another, they suspected anyone who conducted their religious life not in accordance with their particular point of view as being either a Sadducee or a heretic. As a result, they came to a horrible bloodshed and every known evil until the temple was destroyed. This vindicated what happened to them. Since God is upright and does not tolerate such, quote, righteous people, unless they are also diplomatic, not crooked, even if they act for the sake of heaven, for this causes the destruction of creation and the ruin of society. In the previous century, the Chafetz Chaim published the following letter expressing his incredible frustrations. The Chafetz Chaim wrote, "I must speak out my heart about the manner of conflict taking place among the Jewish people. One camp publicizes its view in the newspapers with the signatures of all of its backers. The other side does the same. One of them wrote, 'The one with the most signatures wins.' And I say, 'The one with the most signatures is creating unnecessary conflict in Israel. All of Israel is burning like a fire as each side places more and more ads condemning their opposition. Even the Holy Land of Israel is becoming a subject of controversy. I don't know who permitted all of these terrible sins. Everyone is sure that he is saying the truth, and that it is the other opinion that is creating the argument. This," the Chafetz Chaim wrote, "is a grave error, because even if both are right, they have no right to violate the Torah. So many mitzvot are being violated. No good can possibly come out of this. Right or wrong, they're creating a Chil Hashem. 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died in 1 month, not because they argued, but because they argued improperly and caused a Chil Hashem. Certainly, each one of these giants felt that they were right." Our challenge as serious Jews is, how do we relate to those with whom we differ? How do we live in unity despite disagreeing? And how do we stand up for our own beliefs and yet respect those who disagree with us? It's important to clarify that there are really two types of dispute that I'll be trying to discuss. There are disputes with those who are within our Dalet Amos, those that we see essentially as co-religionists, people that are within what we might call loosely the Torah observant world. And there were those that we have disputes with, those who were chutz l'machane, those who we might consider outside of the pale. Next week I'll be going to a conference in California of over 1,000 Jews for Jesus. These are people that essentially the entire spectrum of the Jewish community considers to be those outside the pale. But how do we deal with such people? The Netziv points out in his introduction to Sefer Bereishis that his comments were directed specifically to those within the traditional Jewish camp, that we have to be able to tolerate and respect the opinions of all who are within this larger camp of Torah Judaism. However, he says that there's obviously limits to pluralism, and not every idea can be koshered. The Torah assumes axiomatically that people are different and that that's actually a positive thing. The Netziv again writes in his commentary to Sefer Bereishit regarding the sins, the tremendous catastrophe that took place with the building of the Tower of Babel, where the Torah says that the people back then were of Dvarim Achadim. They were of singular words, and the Netziv consistently assumes that this means they were of one mind. They were of one mind, the people, or they tried to be of one mind, and they did not tolerate any differences among themselves. Everyone had to be the same. Everyone had to toe the party line. And that was not healthy. So what the Torah says is that God multiplied their languages, scattering them, and essentially restoring the diversity that should have been there in the first place. It's not healthy for everyone to have to be exactly the same. We all know that the Gemara says in Brachot 58a, that just as our faces are all different, so too the way we think is different. No two minds are alike. And appreciating that should lead us to make a special bracha of Baruch Chacham Harazim, that God is able to discern the secrets among people who are incredibly diverse. It's quite beautiful to see the diversity among people. The Holy Kutzke Rebbe famously once said, if I am I because I am I, I'm sorry, he said, if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I and you are not you. But if I am I because I am I and you are you because you are you, then I am I and you are you. I hope that was perfectly clear. We all know that in our davening, we address our prayers to the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And many people have pointed out that the prayer book, our tefillah, does not say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because the God we speak to is not a one-size-fits-all God. That each of our patriarchs developed their own personal, particular approach to having a relationship with God. It's not necessarily the same for each of us. The Midrash teaches that when we crossed the Red Sea, the Yam Suf, 12 lanes opened up, not one lane for all the Jewish people. We don't have necessarily one Nusach for all Jews. We don't have to be all homogenized, and that is healthy. When you know, when it comes to the basics of the practice of Judaism and Yahadut, essentially, we're pretty much unified. A lulav is a lulav, and a matzah is a matzah, and that's why when we put on tefillin, the tefillin that we put on our arm has one compartment. That which we do as Jews, the nuts and bolts of Judaism, is pretty much unified. However, the tefillin we wear on our head has four compartments. Because the way we understand our Yiddishkeit, the way we approach it, the way we relate to it, is not always the same. We can have more than one position, more than one gisha, more than one approach. And that, again, is healthy. The Zohar teaches, Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are 70 multiplied ways of really relating to the Torah. We don't each have the same letter. As the Chazal say, there are 600,000 of these typified Jews, 600,000 letters in the Torah. Each one of us has our own letter. We don't all share the same letter. The Gemara in Erevin says in Daf Yud Gimel that the schools of Hillel and Shammai fought, they argued for many years until finally a bat kol came down from heaven and announced, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and these are both the words of the living God. What an incredibly radical idea that two mutually exclusive points of view can both be right. And yet, the Gemara tells us there that the law, practically speaking, is decided in accordance with the school of Hillel. Why? The Gemara says because Hillel, the school of Hillel, was humble, they were gentle, they were tolerant. And they taught their own views and they taught the views of their opponents, the school of Shammai. They were considerate. They considered the views of their opponents. And they expressed the views of Beit Shammai before they cited their own point of view. So they took their opponents' views seriously. And they were considerate of the opposing points of view. Gemara tells us in Brachot 9b, one of the opinions as to when we're allowed to recite the Shema in the morning. So one of the opinions cited in the Gemara is that we can say the Shema when we're able to see someone from a distance of Dalet Amos and recognize him. Rabbi Saul Weiss, in one of his wonderful books about the Ma'amarei Chazal, explains this homiletically. When is it possible to say Kriyat Shema? Meaning, when is it possible for us to have a relationship with Hashem? When can we truly be a spiritual person? He says, when you can see someone else, someone that's different from you, that's four Amos away. They're not within your Dalet Amos. They're not within your particular sphere. They may be from another camp. And yet you are recognizing them. You grant them some degree of legitimacy. That's when we're able to have a relationship with Hashem. The Medrash in Bereishis states that when the Holy One, blessed be He, came to create the first human being, the ministering angels formed themselves into groups and parties, some of them saying, let man be created, while others said, no, man should not be created. And the angels came in groups. Love came. And love said, let him be created because he will dispense acts of love. But truth came and said, no, he should not be created because he is compounded of falsehood. Righteousness came and said, let him be created because he'll perform righteous deeds. But shalom, peace, came and said, no, he should not be created because he's full of strife. What did Hashem do? It was a 2-2 tie. Two angels arguing to create, two angels arguing not to create. So Kodesh Baruch Hu took truth, he took emes, and cast it to the ground. He broke the tie and now it's 2-1. God creates the world. But the ministering angels came before the Holy One, blessed be He, and said, Sovereign of the universe, why do you despise your beautiful seal? We know that the seal of Hashem, the Chos Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is emes, is truth. Why do you take truth and throw it to the ground? You despise it. Hashem says, no, truth will arise from the ground. Rabbi Cardozo explained this midrash in the following way. He said that when God threw truth down to the ground, it broke into many pieces. Truth shattered into many pieces. Just as white light refracts into many colors, truth broke into many different facets. The facets might appear to be mutually exclusive, like many different colors of the rainbow, of the spectrum. And yet each of these different facets actually reflects and reveals one you of the original pure and perfect light. Rav Moshe Feinstein explained that the Torah is incredibly complex and that probing almost any issue will yield incredible disagreements. Yet these disagreements, Rav Moshe explained, reflects the divine wisdom of the Torah, which is beyond full human comprehension. It's precisely, Rav Moshe says, the fact that we have disagreements in Torah. It's precisely the fact that Torah is not so simple and lends itself to different points of views that expresses the fullness and the grandeur and the beauty of the Torah. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein. I heard a beautiful story once illustrating a little bit about what it means to put this idea of Elu ve'Elu into practice. Not just to talk the talk, but to walk the walk. When I was studying at Yeshiva University in the 70s, I remember one of the Rebbeim was Rav Shusheim, and he was a student himself in the 1940s. Many of the young men at that point would have to go take a job at a synagogue in the high holiday season to support themselves. And Rav Shusheim was looking to find a placement for the high holidays. He came to Rabbi Soloveitchik and asked if maybe Rav Soloveitchik can help him. The Rav says to him, would you like a shul with a mechitza or without a mechitza? Rav Shusheim was flustered because he knew the Rav's position was that it's forbidden to pray in a synagogue without a mechitza, and even if it's on Yom Kippur, it's better, the Rav said, you should go home and daven by yourself than to pray in a shul without a mechitza. Why is the Rav asking me if I would be okay in a shul without a mechitza? The Rav explained that even though it is his position that it's prohibited to daven in a shul without a mechitza, the Rav understood there were those who didn't necessarily agree with him. And he wanted at least to present Rav Shusheim with a range of opinions to follow. It's okay to be strict on himself. He didn't want to necessarily impose this upon his student. He didn't insist that everyone follow his particular point of view. I heard once a beautiful thought from Rav Stern, the Marav Asra, who was at Shari Tefillah for so many years. At a chasana, he quoted a beautiful teaching by the Abter Rav. The Abter Rav wrote a sefer, Ohev Yisrael, taught that in every single parsha of the Torah, there's a lesson about how to have peace between ourselves. And his chassidim once said to him, Rebbe, we don't see it in this week's parsha. And the Rebbe said to them, what are you talking about? Where do you see it in this week's parsha? It's in the name of the parsha. And they said, what are you talking about, the name of the parsha? This is Parshas Balak. And he said, exactly. The name of the parsha teaches you an important lesson about having peace. He said, we don't see it, Rebbe. He said, Balak. It's three letters. It stands for V'ahavta L'rayecha Kamocha. And the Chassidim said, Rebbe, V'ahavta is with a Vav, and Balak is with a Beis. And Kamocha is with a Chaf, and Balak is with a Kuf. He said, that's exactly the point. If everything has to be 100% perfect, you will never have shalom. We have to have flexibility. We have to have the ability not to be so focused and solid and rigid. Rav Moshe Scherer pointed out that when we finish davening and we say, Osei shalom bimromav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu v'al kol Yisrael, we take three steps backwards. He says, in order for us to have peace among the Jewish people, we can't have an insistence stubbornly on only our position and clinging stubbornly only to our position. We sometimes have to take three steps back from where we want to be. The Gemara in Brachos Daf Chof teaches an amazing thing. Gemara says that the Malachi Ashores came to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and they complained. And they said, Hashem, in your holy Torah, it is written that you will not show favor and you will not take bribes. Lo yisaponim v'lo yikach shochad. However, the angels say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you, God, are a hypocrite. Because even though your Torah says you cannot show favoritism, you cannot take a bribe, you, Hashem, show favoritism to the Jewish people. We said in the Birchas Kohanim, Yisa Hashem Panav Elecha. God will show favor to you. The angels wanted to have Hashem explain his inconsistency. God says to the angels, are the Jews not worthy that I should show them favor? Because in my Torah I have written, when you have eaten and are satiated, then you shall bless v'achalta v'savata uveirachta. You have to have sviya. You have to be satiated. You've got to be full before you say birchat hamazon, before you have to say birchat hamazon. So I commanded the Jewish people to thank me when they've eaten, they're full. But Hashem says to the angels, but nevertheless, look at my people. They've adopted the stringency of reciting the grace after meals, even after eating the amount equivalent to an olive or to an egg, to a kezias or kabeya. It's hard to understand this Gemara. What kind of defense is this for the Jewish people and for God? The fact that we're strict with benching, that's why God is able to show favoritism to us? Rav Yaakov Orenstein, in his beautiful Sefer Yeshua's Yaakov, explains this Gemara. He says that in the Mishnah later on in Maseches Brachas, Daf Mem Hei, the Mishnah is discussing how much food you have to have eaten in order to be required to make a zimun, to get together and bench the mezumin. There's a machlokas in the Mishnah between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. Rav Meir says you have had to have eaten a kezias worth of food, an olive volume of food. Rav Yehuda requires a kebeya, an eggs volume. Rav Yaakov Orenstein says that what would happen if there was a mixed group of people and they were eating together? They'd have different points of view in terms of whether they were supposed to bench together. So Rav Yaakov points out that when the students of Rav Meir and the students of Rabbi Yehuda would get together to eat, they would agree ahead of time either to eat less than the kezias or to eat more than a kebeya, so that according to all of them, according to all of their opinions, they either have to not bench b'mezumen or they would all have to bench b'mezumen. And he explains that's why Hashem shows consideration to us. If we as a community work together and we try to work things out together, we try to take other people's opinions and points of view seriously, we don't impose our point of view, we try to work things out so we can get along, Hashem says, how could I not show favoritism to such people? However, it would seem from this Gemara that in order for it to be meriting Hashem's favor, we would have to be considerate and respectful of the approaches of other people different from ourselves. But that's all well and good for those that we consider to be within our own camp, the camp of Torah observance. But what happens with those people who are not inside our Dalet Amos? Those we would consider outside our Machaneh. How do we relate to those who we feel are not really practicing a Judaism that we can accept as legitimate? The Torah in Sefer Vayikra teaches us an important principle. It may not apply specifically here, but the Torah says in Vayikra, Yotes, Yod Zayin, don't hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor. Hocheach, tochiach es hamisecha, and don't bear sin because of him. The Ramban explains that the mitzvah of tochacha is a mitzvah of engagement and dialogue and discussion. When you rebuke your neighbor, you're beginning a conversation with your neighbor. You're entering into a dialogue with your friend. Maybe you don't understand their point of view. Maybe you'll be able to explain to them where they went wrong. But maybe they'll be able to explain to you where you don't understand their point of view. And by entering into this kind of a discussion, this kind of a dialogue, you begin to understand the other, and there's much less chance you'll come to hate the person that you're beginning to understand. That's the flow of the psukim according to the Ramban, that once you engage in this process of tochacha, you will not begin to hate your neighbor in your heart because you've opened up the door of dialogue and discussion. The question is, why does the Torah repeat the word hocheach tochiach? Why double up on the tochacha? The Holy Sfasem has explained that the reason is because we have to be giving some of that tochacha to ourselves. When we have to reprove someone else, when we have to tell someone else that we think they may be missing the mark, the Sfasem says that part of that rebuke has to go on ourselves as well, because we bear some of the responsibility when other Jews are not living properly. We have to include ourselves in the rebuke. As Yisrael Salanter used to say, if it wasn't for Bitul Torah in Volozhin, there wouldn't be Chilul Shabbos in Paris. The Torah observant community in many ways sets the bar for what happens in the Jewish world in general. However, tochacha does not always apply. The Baal HaTanya explained that tochacha generally applies only to those who are within your camp, to those with whom you share values, you have common ground with. But when people are outside of your camp and you don't have common ground with which to give tochacha, the Baal HaTanya says the mitzvah at that point is to love them. The Baal Shem Tov once was approached by one of his Hasidim whose child had gone totally away from Judaism. The Baal Shem Tov said, in that case, you have to love the child even more. When Hashem revealed himself to us at Har Sinai, he begins by saying, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. Our commentaries point out that the language here is very strange. Normally, the way we say the word I in Hebrew is ani. I want ani rotzeh. But here, Hashem begins by saying, I am the Lord your God, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. It's a peculiar way of expressing the word I. The Ishbitzer Rebbe, in his very profound work, the Me'ah Shiloach, says that the wording here was very, very careful. Anochi is basically the word ani with the chaf hadimyon. Anochi is the word ani, I, but it's with the chaf of similitude. Kimo. When Hashem reveals himself to us at Mount Sinai, what the Me'ah Shiloach says, he's not fully revealing himself to us. Hashem is trying to explain, according to the Me'ah Shiloach, that we can never really achieve a full revelation of who God is. So when Hashem says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, it's as we say in modern Hebrew, Ke'ilu. It's as if you're getting some kind of revelation of who I am. But the Torah follows up this first of the Dibros by saying, don't make graven images, which the Me'ah Shiloach understands to mean, don't think that you can carve out a very clear and exact understanding of who God is. He says, once you put God into a box, and you've made that clear graven image, you've made very clear lines of demarcation, that, according to the Me'ah Shiloach, violates the second of the Dibros about not making graven images. I think for us, the lesson here is critical. Because when we become very dogmatic in our theology, it becomes very easy to dismiss other people. But the Me'ah Shiloach is explaining that when it comes to so many of our Ikarei HaEmunah, things are not as simple as we often think they are. They may not be as cut and dry as we think they are. We may not have total clarity on so many things that we think are totally clear. We cannot put God into a box. And so we have to have a little bit of humility in terms of how certain we are and how dogmatic we are about our beliefs. This attitude of humility, I think, is what led Yitz Greenberg to famously say, I don't care what denomination you associate with as long as you're embarrassed by it. We have to all realize that none of us are perfect. And we should be more focused on our own lack of perfection than the lack of perfection of others. We shouldn't be so quick to judge and dismiss other people. We have to be patient with others. There's a very famous story that I love telling. I think it might be a true story. That there was a city once where the official judge and police officer and tax collector, he ran the town, had been embezzling the funds for many years from St. Petersburg. He received a letter saying that he owes 30,000 rubles to the central government. And in a panic, he did the most intelligent thing he could think of. He kidnapped a young Jewish person, held him for ransom. The town got together and realized they didn't have anywhere near the 30,000 rubles. There happened to be at the meeting of this town three rabbis, future rabbis, passing through. Rav Leva Yitzchak of Berditchev, Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, and Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who had gone to become the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. And they were sitting at this meeting, and Shneur Zalman of Liadi said, you know, I have an idea. I know that there's one place we can turn for the money. Don't you remember that on the outskirts of the city here, There's a very, very wealthy man. He's got a fortune of money. And his two friends said, what are you, crazy? He's a Mishumad. He converted years ago and he hates the Jewish people now. Anyone who tries going to him, he'll shoot them. And Shneur Zalman said, but that's the only person that can help us now. The town, the money, we don't have anywhere near 30,000 rubles. And they say, okay, we're going to go with you. He says, you can go on one condition. I do all the talking, you keep your mouth shut. They get to the front door of this palace. The fellow opens the door. He can't believe there are three rabbis standing in front of him. He looks at the rabbis and says, are you crazy for coming here? I would normally have shot you. Shneur Zalman says, listen, we have a desperate situation. There's a young man who was kidnapped. He's being held for ransom and he's an orphan. He was about to get married. This is a young man that was adopted by the city. He was raised by all the people of the city. Next week was supposed to be his wedding. And now the whole wedding is going to be off. His life's going to be destroyed. The woman that was going to marry him, all their dreams are dashed. We have no way of redeeming this man. Please, you have to have mercy, have pity. And Rav Shneur Zalman pours it on for 15 minutes. And the man finally says, okay, okay. Wait here for 1 second. He goes to the next room. He opens up a drawer of a desk. He pulls out a coin, a dirty, rusty coin, and throws it to the rabbi. The two friends look at the coin, and they are about to jump and scream, a chutzpah, you're giving us a coin? And Shneur Zalman says, he turns to the man and says, thank you so much. It's so incredible what you've done for us. It's so generous. It's so wonderful. He thanks this man profusely for 5 minutes, and he says, I can't express our gratitude to you for the wonderful thing that you've done, but you know we need 30,000 rubles. This coin is great. And another 15 minutes of pouring it on. And the man says, okay, okay. And he goes to the drawer, he pulls out another coin, throws it to the rabbi. And now the two friends are about to explode. The chutzpah's mocking us. Another coin? And Shneur Zalman says, no, I'm going to do the talking. And he again thanks the man profusely for 15 minutes. This is so generous, it's so kind, it's so wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate how much you've been able to do for us. But we realize we need 30,000 rubles. And he comes back 5 minutes later with 5 rubles, and then 10 rubles, and then 100, then 500, then 1,000. After a few hours, they get to 30,000 rubles. They bring it to the constable, to the fellow who was kidnapped, the young man. He can't believe he's got a bag of 30,000 rubles now. He decides that St. Petersburg will not miss the money. He's going to skip town. So he makes himself a big party. He gets good and drunk. As he's whipping his horses to get out of town, at that very moment, the wedding is taking place of this young man who was an orphan that was finally freed. The miser, who for so many years distanced himself from the Jewish community, decided after his act of generosity to join the wedding party. He came to celebrate at the wedding. As the wedding is going on, this tax collector, police officer, is whipping his horses ever harder. He finally whips them so hard they crash into the bridge leaving town. He goes flying into the river and drowns. And the bags of money that he had go flying and they land at the feet of the miser, the former miser, at the wedding. The former miser picks up the bags of money and says to the bride and groom, you take these. I want you to have them. It's a cute story. But in the corner are the three rabbis having their huddle. And Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev and Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk go to Shneur Zalman and they say, how in the world did you know how to deal with that man? How did you know how to deal with him? And Shneur Zalman said, do you remember when we first asked him for help? After 15 minutes of pleading, he went to that desk and he pulled out a coin. And do you remember how that coin was dirty and rusty? Do you think we're the first people he tried giving that coin to? Probably many people in desperate need of help went to him, begging for help. And he went to give all he was able to give Nebuch, this rich person. All he was able to part with was a coin. It seems crazy to us, but it's sad. And I had compassion on him, and I realized, Nebuch, that's all he could give. And so I thanked him profusely for all he was able to do. And I encouraged him that we needed more help. But because I was able to receive what he was able to do, I was able to acknowledge what he was able to do, look at what we were able to finally accomplish. So if we're patient with others and realize that sometimes people are where they are, not because they're evil or not because they're rebelling or not because they want to do the wrong thing. There are many reasons why people are not where they should be or where they could be. But sometimes not dismissing them or deriding them, but somehow bonding with them can have a much greater effect in terms of how we are successful. We have to learn how to overlook stereotypes and look beyond the superficial and open ourselves up to the goodness in others. There's a very wonderful book I want to commend to all of you called The Holy Brother about Shlomo Carlebach. One of the stories I'll share with you writes there, 10 years ago, Chaya Adler, a new congregant of the synagogue, met Shlomo Carlebach near a subway station on the Upper West Side. After a few moments of animated discussion, Shlomo said to her with a mischievous twinkle in his eye, "Holy Sister Chai, I'm on my way to meet a Hasidic man who works in the Diamond District. If you're not too busy and have the time, I'd be honored if you would please accompany me." Chaya looked at Shlomo in shock and surprise. "Or Shlomo," she stammered, "I'd love to come along, but I don't want to offend the Hasidic men in the Diamond District. As you see, I'm not dressed properly. I don't think my skirt is long enough." "Don't worry, Sister Chai," Shlomo tried to soothe her. "You have such a holy Jewish face, no one's going to even notice your skirt." Certain that she would encounter a sea of hostility if she ventured into this Hasidic enclave, Chaya valiantly tried to extricate herself from the expedition. But curiously, the more she explained to Shlomo why she couldn't accompany him, the more insistent he became that she do. Before long, Shlomo allayed Chaya's fears, and she joined him on the IRT downtown. As soon as Shlomo hit 47th Street, he was encircled by throngs of Hasidic admirers. Awkwardly, Chaya tried to stand unobtrusively on the side, but each time she made an effort to slip away unnoticed, Shlomo deliberately drew her back to his side and announced to the men, "Everybody should meet my sweetest friend, Holy Sister Chai. Do you know that she is an outstanding scholar and learns Hasidic thought brilliantly?" Each time Shlomo made this and similar announcements to the men, Chaya thought she would die of embarrassment. She was sure that the men would regard her with scorn and derision and greet Shlomo's statement with a patronizing sneer. Instead, to her amazement, they were respectful, friendly, curious, and open. They politely inquired as to which svarim she was studying and were intrigued to learn she was currently immersed in the esoteric teachings of the Ishbitzer Rebbe. Up and down 47th Street, the interactions were unexpectedly the same, positive and upbeat. Having braced herself for trouble, Chaya was not only relieved but pleasantly surprised. Returning to the Upper West Side in a bemused and contemplative state, Chaya suddenly had an epiphany. "It was only upon my return home that I realized that Shlomo, who never wasted an opportunity to perform an act of loving kindness or impart a moral message, had deliberately choreographed the entire encounter. When he saw me near the subway, he seized the occasion to combine his visit to the Diamond District with the opportunity to deliver an important teaching. The teaching directed both at me and the Hasidim we met was quite clearly the importance of letting go of conventional stereotypes. On that fateful day, both they and I learned a valuable lesson: to suspend judgment, to look beyond dress and appearance for the divine spark that resides in each soul. From that day forward, I began to look at Hasidim as individuals, not as stereotypes. I'm equally certain that their own perception of modern Jewish women had altered perceptibly as a result of our exchange and would never quite be the same again." Lubavitcher Rebbe taught once that Judaism is ultimately a ladder connecting heaven to earth with 613 steps. And Rebbe explained that we should never judge ourselves or others by how high or low we are on this ladder. to say and make the mistake, well, this person's keeping 500 mitzvot and this one's only keeping a dozen or so mitzvot. The Rebbe explained that we should judge ourselves and others by whether or not we're moving up or down on that ladder. We can meet someone who we assume is so advanced Jewishly, but the truth is that they're treading water or maybe even falling back slightly, imperceptibly. We can meet someone who we think is so far away from Judaism, but we don't appreciate sometimes the few mitzvot they do and sacrifice to do, how holy and special and beautiful they are. The Gemara in Chagiga Daf Tezvav tells the famous story of Rav Meir and his teacher, Elisha ben Avuya, who we know became a heretic, an incredibly serious heretic, to the point where the rabbis removed his name from the Talmud. He's now referred to as Acher. And Rav Meir continued to learn from his teacher. And when Rav Meir was asked, how is it that you study from someone who's an incredible heretic? Rav Meir explained that I eat the outer flesh of the fruit and I spit out the pit. But I don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Ultimately, our obligation in life is to model ourselves on how God deals with us and with the world. We know that Hashem is incredibly tolerant. In Sefer Tomer Devorah, this famous Mekubal explains that God is tolerant beyond our imagination. At the very moment that people sin against God, the very moment people are sinning against God, who is giving them the air to breathe with? Who is animating their limbs that they're using to sin against Him? God puts up and tolerates an immense amount. And therefore, we cannot simply dismiss others and write them off. Rav Kook, as we all know, was a role model for how to deal with Jews who were outside of our camp. We know that he dealt significantly with the Chalutzim, who were not just non-religious in Israel, but were even anti-religious. But Rav Kook felt that despite their anti-religiosity, whatever that meant, they were doing something important and valuable. They were resettling the land of Israel, and Rav Kook appreciated their incredible self-sacrifice in helping to resettle the land. Even he felt having more Mesiris Nefesh than those who were quote-unquote religious Jews. So Rav Kook was able to value their contributions just like Rav Meir was able to value that which was legitimate from his former teacher, Elisha ben Avuya. In one famous story, Rav Kook had a meeting with a rabbi whose son had become a communist and very antagonistic to Judaism. Rav Kook encouraged this rabbi to stay close with his son. Now, the son was raised as a religious Jew and could not be considered a tinok shenishba. But Rav Kook said that your son got carried away by the spirit of the time. And therefore, your son should be considered to be an ones, someone who is ultimately not in control. They've been essentially forced into the way they're behaving. Your boy was motivated by idealism and dedicated to important ideals. Your son wants to do good. He does not want to be an evil person. He wants to make the world a better place. And therefore, you have to have tolerance for your son. Kabbalistically, Rav Kook believed that everything that exists has a divine spark of holiness that animates it. Rav Kook taught that without this divine spark, it would not exist. It would cease to exist. And the fact that something exists, according to the Kabbalistic teachings, proves that there must be something on some level that is holy within it. Our job is to try to find that spark of holiness, to try to reveal that hidden holiness. This is something that Rav Shlomo Carlebach was a master at doing, even within those who seem to have strayed from Judaism. We know that in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, when there's a tremendous struggle over who is going to receive the mantle of leadership from Isaac. Isaac had his two sons, Esav and Jacob. And we know that Isaac favored Esav. And there's a tremendous amount of tension in the story. And we know that at the last minute, the fortunes change and it's Jacob who receives the blessings. But immediately before receiving the blessings, the Torah says about Yitzchak, Vayorach es begodov, that Isaac smelled the garments of the child who was in front of him. He was assuming that this child is Esau because they're hairy. But he smells the garments. And the Medrash says, Al tikri begodav ela bogdav. Do not read this as he smelled his garments, but he smelled those who would rebel in the future against Torah and against Judaism. That ultimately, what is able to secure the blessings for Jacob is Isaac's ability to sense that out of Jacob will come holy rebels, will come those who rebel against Judaism, but they're holy. There's a spark of holiness in them. Our job ultimately has to be to nurture that spark and channel it in a positive direction. And I believe that it's only if we, with a tremendous amount of wisdom, with a tremendous amount of humility, and a tremendous amount of love, are able to relate to Jews that are not necessarily within our personal sphere of Judaism, that we'll be able to develop healthier relationships among our people and begin to reverse the hatred that has been plaguing us and poisoning our community for all these thousands of years. We should see the redemption. B'nei Rav Yameinu.